This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
This week on Freakonomics Radio, when you think about propaganda campaigns, I am guessing you don't think of this.
Shop your Safeway store. You will always save.
After World War I and World War II came the Cold War between the U.S. and the USSR. It featured a space race, an arms race, and a farms race.
Chicken breeding and hybrid corn took a outsized and somewhat surprising role in U.S. propaganda.
The farms race had an obvious winner.
We clearly won the abundance war.
But the American victory was, to some degree, a Pyrrhic victory, whose after effects are still being felt.
Economists who don't do U.S. agricultural policy are horrified by what they see in terms of distorting markets.
How a sprawling system of agriculture technology, economic policy, and political will came to life in the supermarket. It's coming up on Freakonomics Radio right after this hour's news. The supermarket is so ubiquitous today that it's hard to imagine the world without it. But of course, such a time did exist.
There's some debate about when supermarkets actually started, but usually we pin it at around 1930.
That's Shane Hamilton. He's an American historian who teaches at the University of York in England.
I am the author of Supermarket USA, Food and Power in the Cold War Farms Race.
Was the supermarket a purely American invention?
I argue yes. The easy answer is that the first declared supermarket was built in the United States. I think the broader answer is that what makes a supermarket is the industrial agriculture system that enables the affordability of mass-produced foods.
The predecessor of the supermarket was the dry goods store.
So they didn't have fresh produce. They didn't necessarily have milk or meat or a bakery in-house. That's what a supermarket did, is it put all those food items and often many other things. You could get, you know, auto parts. You could get your shoes shined in the early supermarkets. It was a kind of one-stop shopping and service emporium.
Another big difference, supermarkets were self-serve. In a dry goods shop, you'd ask a clerk for something, and they'd fetch it. In a supermarket, you could ogle the meat and produce yourself, even handle it, and then put it in your basket. The supermarket chain Piggly Wiggly is credited with having pioneered the self-service retail model. It is still operating today in 17 states, but the biggest supermarket chain for much of the 20th century was A&P, the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company.
A&P, as of the 1940s, was the world's largest retailer by any measure, by sales volume, by number of outlets, and so forth.
Between 1946 and 1954 in the U.S., the share of food bought in supermarkets rose from 28% to 48%. By 1963, that number had risen to nearly 70%. A&P had so much market power that the Department of Justice went after it for anti-competitive practices. This was an interesting development, considering that the U.S. government played such a significant role in the creation of supermarkets in the first place.
The original goal had been to use the supermarkets to drive down the cost of food for urban consumers.
The U.S. becomes a majority urban nation by, I think, 1920. And there's a lot of anxiety among leaders, political leaders, thought leaders, about whether or not U.S. agriculture is going to be productive enough to feed this growing urban population.
That's Anne Efland.
I'm a senior economist in USDA's Office of Chief Economist, and I work primarily on domestic policy.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture, established in 1862, had a long history of funding and conducting scientific research.
You know, a lot of the seed development and livestock breeding, one good example would be the research done in the 1890s on animal disease, on bovine tuberculosis, for example, to identify the causes of those diseases and then to develop ways to treat that. There was also research on developing new kinds of machinery that would, you know, be less heavy on the ground or less damaging to crops.
The USDA's promotion of agriculture went even further than farm machinery and animal breeding.
There was a need for better transportation from the farms to the cities. So USDA had a unit that did engineering research on the best road materials and road construction methods. The Rural Electrification Administration was part of the New Deal USDA. The private electrical companies didn't see a profit in expanding out into rural areas, and so that was taken on by USDA.
But perhaps the biggest changes to American agriculture were mechanization and automation.
If I may say so, I lived through the structural transformation of the agricultural economy.
That's Peter Timmer, an economist who used to teach at Harvard.
I'm a retired professor, have worked on agriculture and food policy, poverty reduction, economic development for well over 50 years now.
And before that, Timmer was a farm boy in Ohio. He worked for the Tip Top Canning Factory, which was founded by his great-grandfather, and the factory's tomato farm.
I'm old enough to remember when we hand-picked all of our tomatoes and we hand-peeled all of our tomatoes.
But that, of course, changed.
When I was in grade school or junior high school, if we could pack 40 or 50,000 cases of canned tomatoes and product in a year, that was a pretty successful year. By the time I had graduated from graduate school, the company was putting out 1 million cases a year.
This was thanks in large part to a mechanical tomato harvester, which came out of the engineering school at the University of California, Davis, with the help of federal research money. It had taken years to get the harvester right, mostly because they first had to get the tomato right, breeding a new variety that could withstand the rough treatment of the mechanical harvester.
I remember when we bought our first one, it was a huge expense, and it just revolutionized our operation. I was just in a microcosm of what turned out to be very general trends in the entire U.S. food system at the time.
The general trends could best be characterized as high volume and standardized agriculture. If you would describe U.S. agriculture policy as aggressive in earlier decades, then in the Cold War era, it was pretty much on steroids. And this wasn't just about feeding a growing U.S. population. This had a political thrust, meant to show the Soviet Union and the rest of the world just how mighty the U.S. was. Shane Hamilton again.
I don't mean to deny the power and the might of these weapon systems that were deployed and the space race and all that. But fundamentally, this was a contest to demonstrate that either communism or capitalism was a superior political economic system.
After Sputnik, when the United States was trying to understand why it was falling behind in the space race, or why it thought it was falling behind in the space race, many of the commentators said, the problem is we're not funding basic research. So after 1957, the budgets of not only organizations like the National Science Foundation, but also specific government departments like the Department of Agriculture, their budgets for research increased dramatically on the theory that this is how the United States would win the Cold War, by doing the best science.
That is Audra Wolfe.
I'm a writer, editor, and historian.
Wolfe's latest book is called Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science.
And it really looks at the ways that science as an idea became a tool for propaganda in the Cold War, especially on the American side. There's this idea that you can change hearts and minds and you can establish a climate of opinion that makes people more willing to accept the American way of life as the better choice.
And one of the things that made America so great, its agricultural system.
Things like chicken breeding and hybrid corn took a outsized and somewhat surprising role in U.S. propaganda in the early 1950s.
But there was a tension.
The United States wanted to promote personal exchanges, scientific and technical exchanges, as a way to promote American values. But at the same time, it was very, very nervous that by doing so, it would lose the advantages that it had, particularly in grain production.
In 1955, the U.S. government unexpectedly had its hand forced.
A newspaper editor in Iowa named Lauren Soth invited Khrushchev to the United States to see the wonders of American agriculture.
That's Nikita Khrushchev, then leader of the Soviet Union.
And somewhat to everyone's shock, Khrushchev said yes. Now, Khrushchev didn't come himself until 1959. But in 1955, a group of 12 Soviet agricultural experts came to the United States to see the wonders of American agriculture. They saw how contour farming worked. They saw the wonders of hybrid corn. They saw the chicken breeders.
chicken in the 1920s was pound for pound as expensive as lobster. By the 1960s, it was so cheap that it was quickly becoming America's most popular meat.
What can you tell us about the Chicken of Tomorrow project?
The Chicken of Tomorrow. Really, the Chicken of Tomorrow is the chicken of today, in that we're all eating the kind of genetic progeny of the original Chicken of Tomorrow. What it was a contest to produce the most efficient chicken using genetic techniques, basically. And it not only had to be an efficient chicken, but very heavy breasts, very light colored feathers, so that when it's plucked, it would look good under cellophane and then later plastic packaging. And the birds had to be relatively disease resistant so that they could be put in intensive rearing operations without dying too quickly.
This agricultural bounty, those heavy-breasted cheap chickens, those millions of cases of tomatoes, all this was a good candidate for the U.S. propaganda machine.
The U.S. Information Agency were searching for concrete forms of propaganda to display America's wealth.
Enter one of the most concrete forms of display imaginable, the supermarket.
A supermarket is not just a retail box, but actually the endpoint of an industrial agriculture supply chain. A supermarket can't exist without the inputs of mass-produced foods. The farms race was about how do you get the food from industrially productive, technologically sophisticated farms to, you know, this display of abundance, and the display was really crucial.
Since the average citizen living under communism wouldn't have access to a Piggly Wiggly or an A&P, the U.S. government brought the supermarket to the communists.
The 1957 Supermarket USA exhibit in Zagreb, Yugoslavia, which was then a communist country. It was a fully operational 10,000 square foot American supermarket filled with frozen foods and breakfast cereals and everything else. They airlifted in fresh produce from the U.S. because they didn't think Yugoslavian produce was attractive enough. It was about this display of affordable abundance available to American consumers.
For anyone who didn't get the message, there was also a sign touting, quote, the knowledge of science and technology available to this age. In other words, if you like our breakfast cereal, just think how much you like the rest of our capitalism.
There were quite a few people who thought that if you showed that American consumers could access affordable food, you know, strawberries in December, without having to wait in line, that might actually cause the whole communist system to collapse.
The Supermarket USA exhibit proved tremendously popular. More than 1 million Yugoslavs visited. Some received free bags of American food.
Immediately after seeing it, Marshal Tito, the leader of the country at the time, ordered the whole thing to be purchased. And it was bought wholesale from the United States exhibitors and used as a model. They hired a consultant from an Atlanta supermarket firm to come over and teach them how to build their own chain of socialist supermarkets.
So Yugoslavia, along with other European countries, started building American-style supermarkets, which created new buyers for processed and frozen foods from America. This did not, however, lead to a wider embrace of American culture, much less the downfall of communism. But just a couple of years later, the Americans took another shot, this time in Moscow, at the American National Exhibition. They built a split-level, ranch-style American house. Its kitchen stocked with food and the latest labor-saving appliances. The message was clear. The American economy, based in free market capitalism, was capable of producing things that the Soviets' command and control economy simply couldn't. The exhibition opening was attended by Nikita Khrushchev and then U.S. Vice President Richard Nixon. They engaged in what came to be known as the kitchen debate.
You must not be afraid of ideas.
That's what we're telling you. Don't be afraid of ideas. We have nothing to fear. The time has passed when ideas scared us.
Well, then let's have more exchange of them.
Richard Nixon and Nikita Khrushchev, they are two of the most explicit users of this Cold War farms race language. Khrushchev declared that by outproducing the U.S. in per capita meat and milk production, that would be the Soviet equivalent of hitting American capitalism with a torpedo. Nixon retorted that if there was going to be a torpedo fired, it was going to be by America's farmers and ranchers, to which the farmers and ranchers listening to his speech applauded very mightily.
A few months afterward, Khrushchev finally visited the U.S., and he got to see for himself the sprawling cornfields of Iowa. But this was of little help to the Soviet farmers back home.
The fact is, they were unable to modernize Soviet agriculture with the economic structure and strategy that they were following.
The economist Peter Timmer again.
It was not a technological problem. It was a management and marketing problem. There was a total divorce between what consumers wanted and what the managers of the big state farms were told to produce.
Timmer was part of a World Bank team that visited the Soviet Union. He saw for himself their agricultural system and supermarkets.
Oh, gosh. I mean, the shelves were empty. It was just weird. We stayed at a government hotel, and there was hardly anything to eat. You talk with the staff of the research agencies and places like that who would struggle just to come up with basic foods. They knew it could be better than that.
Khrushchev, despite his bravado, was ultimately forced to buy imported grain from the U.S.
Some historians would argue that this was one of the crucial factors that led to his downfall, that it was just embarrassing on the world stage for the Soviet Union. This vast country with enormous agricultural resources having to turn to its arch enemy for grain.
Khrushchev's successor, Leonid Brezhnev, continued the policy of importing food from the U.S. to cover domestic shortfalls. If the two countries had been normal trading partners, this wouldn't have been a big deal. But they weren't normal trading partners. They were Cold War adversaries, the global icons of capitalism and communism. And it was becoming clear which system would prevail, at least on the food front. Peter Timmer's final analysis?
It was a fundamentally failed strategy for agriculture that brought down the Soviet Union. They didn't grow enough and they didn't grow the right things. And there were no price signals telling you what's expensive and what's cheap. They wasted a lot of what they were producing on the land. It never got into the supermarkets.
Timmer was actually in Moscow when the Soviet Union collapsed.
The neat thing is I have a passport going in stamped Soviet Union, but my passport coming out, the exit stamp is Russia. People were so optimistic about what was going to happen. They knew that American supermarkets were a miracle. They had seen it on television. That point had clearly gotten through, at least to everybody that I talked to.
And so it seems as though the mighty supermarket may indeed have played a role in America's Cold War victory.
Yeah, I mean, this is central to the kind of lie, really, of the supermarket as a weapon.
The historian Shane Hamilton again.
So when the supermarket is upheld as this, you know, effectively missile, this concrete consumer weapon against the claims of communism, it's built on this idea that supermarkets are producing this affordability just through the workings of supply and demand, that, you know, it's unfettered markets that are somehow making food so affordable for American consumers. Where the reality is, there's massive government investment in the science and technology that enables the productivity of American farms, from fertilizers to frozen food processes to distribution and so forth. And that's all erased. The image is that it's just the supermarket itself that is the source of abundance.
So when you describe it like that, it's certainly, I mean, you use the word lie and you talk about the hidden components and you make it certainly sound nefarious. But couldn't you argue that, you know, the role of a government is to invest in science and technology that'll benefit private industry and ultimately the citizenry?
Yeah, I actually don't have a problem with the U.S. government investment in science and technology and encouraging, you know, more productivity. The concern is with, you know, that being disguised as a free market when it's not particularly free. I mean, taking that to a propaganda level and attacking another country for not having free markets, it's just duplicitous, right?
You may or may not be as disturbed as Shane Hamilton is by what he calls the duplicity of the U.S. government for promoting the supermarket as an emblem of free market capitalism. To me, the big question is this. What was the ultimate cost of this supermarket victory? What are the economic and political and health consequences of more than 100 years of agriculture policy that encouraged industrialization, standardization, and low prices? That's coming up right after this.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by TransferWise, a new way to manage money across borders. Over 6 million people and businesses use TransferWise to send, spend, and receive money internationally. More at transferwise.com/freakonomics or on the app.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So the U.S. won the so-called farms race with an industrial approach to agriculture that was heavily influenced by government policy and funding. What were the long-term results of that victory? To figure that out, we need to go back about 100 years. That's on the advice of Ann Eflind, the U.S. Department of Agriculture economist we've been hearing from. Eflind thinks there's one key event that really drove U.S. food policy.
And that is production increases around World War I. Farmers expanded their production to meet wartime goals, and there were some price supports during that time that provided incentives for increased, especially wheat and pork and some of these other staple commodities. But there was no real planning for the aftermath after the increased demand and the price supports that are set up for war go away. And it left a number of farmers who had, in good faith, developed larger farms and more productive farms with very low prices.
So after the war, farmers were producing more food than was necessary. Then came the Great Depression. The economist Peter Timmer.
I mean, demand collapsed, but agricultural productivity did not. And what that meant was prices just collapsed. And so that so totally set the mind frame for U.S. agricultural policy.
That's when we see the beginning of real price policies for agriculture.
Price policies for agriculture would take many forms over the ensuing decades, from crop insurance to loans and direct payments and many more. Now, you can understand why the government would want to make agriculture financially viable and remove some of the uncertainty. A national food supply is a pretty important thing. One key policy tool the government used was a price support system, guaranteeing farmers a certain minimum price for a specific crop at a specific time.
There was an idea of something called parity, which was that the price should be such that it would give farmers the same purchasing power in comparison to workers and others in the economy that they had had before World War I, and that was the guideline for what those price support levels ought to be.
But if you increase the price being paid without limiting the amount being produced, well,
one of the problems with this is that it leads to a large surplus.
This would leave the federal government to buy and store excess produce. In the early 1930s, when the U.S. government guaranteed farmers 80 cents per bushel of wheat, the government wound up buying and storing more than 250 million bushels.
These things all take place in the context of their own times. Having policies that found a way to increase farm incomes in the 1930s, I think, would be seen as a good thing. But there are also consequences of that over time as they get embedded.
If you ever wonder why the USDA's old food pyramid, the diagram of recommended servings of different foods, why the biggest category at the bottom of the pyramid was bread, cereal, rice, and pasta, well, the U.S. had an awful lot of all those foods. And if you ate as the USDA instructed, there's a good chance you put on a few pounds. You can't think about nutrition without thinking about agriculture policy. And U.S. agriculture came to be driven by financial incentives. Incentives that, given how government funding often works, weren't always entirely sensible.
You know, economists who don't do U.S. agricultural policy are usually horrified by what they see in terms of distorting markets, picking, okay, corn, soybeans, wheat, you guys get big subsidies. Apples, grapes, fresh fruits and vegetables, you're on your own. Dairy, incredibly regulated, both federally and at the state level. Just a mess, just an awful mess.
With price guarantees for certain crops and the resultant glut of supply, the government sometimes paid farmers to plant fewer crops. But even this wasn't fully successful.
So we have controls on how much can you plant on an acre, but not on how much your yield is on the acres you are planting. There's a huge boom, lots of new chemicals, fertilizers, machinery that make farms more productive. So even though we're trying to control by reducing the acreage, there continues to be increasing production and surpluses don't go down.
But Ann Eflin says this was a problem the USDA wasn't all that unhappy about.
Problem solving on the scientific and technical and engineering side tends to run on its own track and be seen as a positive outcome. I don't think there's ever a point at which the policy side is saying, oh, stop providing good science and better agricultural practices so we don't have these surpluses. Because when you do that, what you're saying is then stop this economic development. Solving problems and making farming more efficient are still seen as good projects to continue. The fact that they also create these surpluses is sort of a different track of problems that the farm policy then is trying to figure out solutions to.
One solution was to use surplus grain for animal feed. Shane Hamilton again.
Those massive surpluses of cheap corn and later soybeans encourages the rise of, you know, industrial meat production, concentrated animal production, livestock feeding operations, where, you know, that's enabled by cheap grain production.
Industrial meat production fueled by cheap grain meant cheap meat, too, and helps explain how the U.S. became one of the world's biggest consumers of meat per capita. Today, more than 30% of corn, more than 50% of soybeans grown in the U.S. goes toward feeding cattle and other livestock. But even that left a lot of surplus production. So what happened?
High fructose corn syrup. Yep, you've got surplus corn, and you've got a demand for easy, convenient sweetener in the food sector. And that was just a perfect storm. That syrup revolutionizes food processing because instead of a powdery sweet thing, it's a liquid, and liquids are way easier to handle in food processing. If I had only one thing to say about the impact of our agricultural programs on what you see in the supermarket and subsequent health issues out of the diet, I would have said the fact that we use so much high fructose corn syrup, that's the example of how things can go badly wrong, even if well-intended.
The rise in agricultural productivity tended to favor larger, more industrial farms. It didn't hurt that they often received the government price supports designed for smaller family farms. As you can imagine, this began to put a lot of small farms out of business.
We didn't manage that process very well, but I think just basic economic forces would have pushed us in that direction. It just wouldn't have pushed us as far.
Peter Timmer, you will recall, grew up working on the tomato farm and cannery founded by his great-grandfather. You'll also recall when the Tip Top Canning Company got their first mechanical tomato harvester.
It just revolutionized our operation.
When the mechanical harvester was introduced, there were around 5,000 tomato growers in the U.S. Within 5 years, 4,400 had gone out of business. The Timmer family farm and canning factory made the cut. They're still operating today. But between 1940 and 1969, 3.4 million American farmers and their families stopped farming.
Quite a few historians suggest that, you know, this all-out push to productivity killed the family farm, effectively.
Shane Hamilton again.
And it's hard to deny that. On the other hand, we don't apply the same kind of metrics to, you know, industrial manufacturing, where similarly, there's been massive U.S. Government investment in science and technology to support economic growth and productivity. I'm sympathetic to those who, you know, see it as overall a net positive gain. However, you know, the pain is real.
Peter Timmer says this massive consolidation on the production side was driven by what was happening on the consumption side, the growth of supermarket chains.
Supermarkets were able to manage the supply chains all the way back to farmers, but they didn't want little tiny farmers. Just one supplier, please. It's just way too complicated to contract with 50 or 100. That has changed then the nature of production, right down at the level of Tip Top Canning Company and how we would be able to provide the kind of regular quality and supply and low price that a Walmart or a Kroger or a Publix would need.
I mean, Walmart really came in and looked at the landscape of American supermarkets and saw inefficiencies everywhere. What Walmart did was build on its successful model of general merchandise sales with hyper-efficient logistics and distribution, brought that into the supermarket industry and really shook things up.
I used to ask my class, I'm talking 1985, where is the world's largest supercomputer? And the correct answer was, it's at the Pentagon. Okay, where is the world's second largest supercomputer? Bentonville, Arkansas, home of Walmart. They used that computer to track every single item on every single Walmart shelf. That information technology is what revolutionized food marketing. And it was pretty much invented by Walmart.
This technology would spread across the world, affecting not just the demand side, supermarkets, but the agriculture supply side.
So the U.S. experience is formative. And it's formative for two reasons. One, U.S. universities train so many ag economists, food scientists, food policy people to go back to other countries that the U.S. model is pretty well ingrained intellectually. But the other thing, of course, is the biological and mechanical technologies mostly came out of the United States.
Another consequence of the scaling up of American agriculture, more standardization and less variety.
So apples, in the early 20th century, consumers in, say, New York State would have access to literally hundreds of varieties. You know, even in mass retail markets, by the mid-20th century, it's down to just a handful. And, you know, Red Delicious really dominates the whole market. And apples became remarkably tasteless by the mid-20th century. You know, so certain qualities were given up in order to gain that advantage of price and abundance.
Well, you know, we clearly won the food wars in terms of supply and abundance. We won the abundance war. What we may be in the process of losing is the health and quality dimensions going forward.
I think today we're certainly witnessing, perhaps especially among millennials, an attempt to kind of reconfigure values. You know, what are you actually looking for when you go to a supermarket? It's not just price. Price does not contain all relevant information for many shoppers in a contemporary supermarket. So the costs of pollution, of, you know, degraded animal welfare that are currently not being borne by either producers or consumers of food would have to be borne.
If we had worried much, much more about the quality of farmland, of sustainability, about environmental side effects from heavy fertilization on corn. You know, we've got a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico that is directly attributable to putting fertilizer on corn up in the Midwest. I accused my brothers of poisoning the Gulf of Mexico, and they said, well, what are we going to do? We have to get high yields. There was this sense of everybody being trapped in an old paradigm. And now, how do we break out of that? We have to make agriculture green, which is a strange thing to say.
Peter Timmer has seen a lot of change in the farming business over his lifetime. And who knows, maybe he'll see the change he's hoping for now. But it's going to be hard to break the status quo, at least in terms of how financial incentives drive food production. For instance, when the Trump administration placed billions of dollars of tariffs on Chinese imports, China responded with their own tariffs on imported American crops like soybeans, alfalfa, and hay. American crop exports to China fell dramatically, as did, of course, farmers' revenues. Earlier this year, the U.S. government put together a welfare package to U.S. farmers. The price tag? $16 billion. Coming up, the connection between Girl Scout cookies, which you famously cannot buy in supermarkets, and leadership.
Half of all female elected officials in America were Girl Scouts.
And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive on the Stitcher app or at Freakonomics.com, where you'll also find our books, the blog, and much more.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by TransferWise, a new way to manage money across borders. Over 6 million people and businesses use TransferWise to send, spend, and receive money internationally. More at TransferWise.com/Freakonomics or on the app. And by Indeed. With Indeed, employers can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on a short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Here's a question. What do Nancy Pelosi, Elizabeth Warren, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have in common? Sure, they're all female members of the United States Congress, and they're all Democrats, but it goes beyond that. All three female secretaries of state, Hillary Clinton, Condoleezza Rice, and Madeleine Albright, they all have this same thing in common, too. But also, Taylor Swift, Meghan Markle, and Queen Latifah, Melinda Gates, Venus and Serena Williams, and nearly every female astronaut who's ever been in space? Yes, all these women were once Girl Scouts, as was Sylvia Acevedo, who's telling me about a rule she learned when she was a kid. This rule, she says, has been a big force in her life and helped shape her impressive career. It is called the Rule of Three No's. I ask her to demonstrate with some role play. I'm playing a grumpy old man who just answered his doorbell. And she's playing, well, it'll be obvious who she's playing.
So, you know, first I would ask you if you would like to buy some wonderful, delicious Girl Scout cookies.
And I would say, do I look like I need to eat more cookies, little girl? Get off my doorstep. No.
And I'd say, you know, buying cookies, you can eat them for yourself or you can give them. They're really very delicious. People at your work or your family would really enjoy having these cookies. So I would really encourage that.
I'm retired and my wife died and I have no family. I don't want your cookies. Get off my porch, little girl.
All right. Well, you know, sir, it sounds like you would need some more friends. And I would really encourage you to buy a box of cookies and take it to your neighbor. And you could meet your neighbors and they would really enjoy getting this box of cookies from you, sir.
Who exactly is this clever and determined woman?
I'm Sylvia Acevedo and I'm CEO of Girl Scouts of the USA.
And what exactly is the Girl Scouts mission?
Creating girls of courage, confidence, and character who make the world a better place.
So what I want to know is which came first, Sylvia Acevedo, the smart, disciplined self-starter, or Sylvia Acevedo, the Girl Scout? And what I mean by that is, you know, you've got this remarkable record of accomplishment and discipline and intellect, much of it accomplished with not very much advantage and often active disadvantage. You also, though, joined the Girl Scouts when you were young, and you've said that that gave you a big boost, but you were someone who, it seems, had so much drive that I wonder if you really needed the Girl Scouts. I wonder which direction the arrow is traveling in.
So about 14 years ago, somebody was doing research at Stanford, and they called me and they said, you know, you're one of the first Hispanic male or females to have ever gotten your graduate engineering degree from Stanford, and unfortunately, you're still one of the few. So they said, so how did all this happen? You know, were your parents, you know, college professors? No. And so they kept saying, well, how are you prepared with the math and the science? And the more they kept asking, it did go back to that pivotal Girl Scout experience.
Acevedo recently published a book for middle school readers called Path to the Stars, My Journey from Girl Scout to Rocket Scientist.
I did this book tour and I went across the country, urban, rural, suburban areas. And what I was struck with, I saw that as the girls got older, so like when they're in the early ages in elementary school, there's just this exuberance and enthusiasm and raising their hands. By the time they get to middle school, they don't raise their hands. And so much so that I started to institute a rule that I would only take questions if they were alternating boy, girl. And we do know that in classrooms, boys get called on more than girls. And I think about in our girl-only space, I think that's why Girl Scouts tend to over-index in so many non-traditional fields. Half of all female elected officials in America were Girl Scouts. So I think that girl-only environment allows you to try things safely. And also, if you don't succeed the first time, it's not like, okay, you tried it, you're not going to be good at it, you're not good at a computer, so get away from it. You get to try and try again until you either decide you like it or you see success in it. And I know that's what happened to me.
Acevedo is 61 years old. She was born in South Dakota.
I was born in South Dakota, but I grew up in Las Cruces, New Mexico. All my grandparents were born in Mexico. My mom was born in Mexico. My dad was born in El Paso, Texas. And we lived in a Spanish-speaking household. We lived paycheck to paycheck. Sometimes we ran out of money. We had to go live with other family members. You know, this was my reality. Because of where we lived, unfortunately, there was a health epidemic of meningitis, and my sister got really sick. And we moved because my mother realized the only part of town where people got sick was in this dirt street neighborhood that we lived in, and we moved to another part of town. But I didn't like it because I had all my friends, everything that I knew there. But at that point, you know, a girl followed me and pestered me to come to see Girl Scouts, and then I just fell in love with Girl Scouts.
The Girl Scouts were founded in 1912 by a Georgia woman named Juliet Gordon Lowe. She'd been inspired by the Boy Scout model. Lowe wanted girls to have the space to learn self-reliance in everything from camping and cooking to citizenship and career training. It was on a Girl Scout camping trip that Sylvia Acevedo first got interested in science.
My troop leader saw me just looking at the night sky. She helped me understand that there were constellations and there was, you know, planets. And I had no idea. I just knew there were twinkly lights. But she remembered that and later on encouraged me to earn my science badge. And I wasn't successful at first. I mean, it took me quite a few times before I was successful.
Acevedo was trying to get her science badge by launching an Estes model rocket. She had a really hard time getting it off the ground.
I was like, what is this that won't let my rocket go up? And so I learned about this invisible force called gravity that keeps things down. And in fact, I really did get kind of really inspired of like trying to figure out how do you break gravity's grip?
How do you break gravity's grip? This is something Acevedo learned to do again and again. She started playing basketball, even though her parents thought that wasn't something a girl should be doing. And she got really good. She started playing music and, of course, chose the drums. And again, she got really good. Acevedo was so frustrated after the family car broke down on a trip that she set about learning auto repair, even though she wasn't old enough to drive. She also started thinking big about her academic future.
When I was in fourth grade, my fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Baldwin, showed different pictures of colleges across America. And I'm in the Chihuahua Desert. It's one of the driest and most arid deserts.
One of the pictures Mrs. Baldwin showed was of Stanford University.
So you see these green verdant hills and the limestone buildings with the red tiled roof. And I did blurt out, I want to go there.
She would go on to Stanford for graduate school. But first, there were some other hurdles, like the high school college counselor.
When she walked out and she looked at me, she said, what are you doing here? And I said, I signed up to go to college counseling. And she said, girls like you don't go to college. And to be fair, statistically, she was probably right. But that didn't mean she was right in saying what she said. But by that time, that was just my first no. And so I just stood up and walked into her office. And, you know, she followed me. And then she said, what do you want to study? And I said, I want to be an engineer. And she laughed.
At the time, around 1% of undergraduate engineering degrees were earned by women.
So I went to New Mexico State University and I became an industrial engineer, a systems engineer. And my first job out of college was as a rocket scientist at NASA's JPL.
I think when a lot of people would hear a story like that about your counselor telling you that girls like you don't go to college, it's so insulting. And I think that most people, when they hear that story, if they put themselves in that position, they would imagine themselves responding with anger or hurt or resentment. And you sound and appear to be the kind of person who was able to let that kind of thing roll off you and then get to the next level, keep pushing for your goal. I'm really curious whether you think that ability is your natural characteristic, whether you learned that, if it was hard to learn, and really if you have any advice for people who, when they face, you know, a no, a failure, how to not let the weight of that failure keep them from moving forward.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that has to do a lot with problem solving. I know in my career, I faced this quite a bit. There was one company that I was working for, and I wanted to move from domestic sales to international sales. And I saw that there were some openings for people who, you know, could speak Spanish and had this technical background. And I could not break in. It took months. And there was just always some excuse why, you know, why it wasn't a fit. And so I kept trying to figure out, so, you know, how do I get this so that they can't say no? And, you know, I love numbers, right? So numbers are sort of my superpower. So I did a lot of data analysis and I showed that if their penetration of some major multinational accounts was the same as my accounts, that region would have hundreds of millions of dollars more in sales. And I created this presentation. And so I got that 5 minutes with that really busy sales VP. And I flipped through the presentation and he looked at that and he's like, oh my gosh, this is really great. And so he went to grab it and he said, well, can't I have it? And I put my hand on it and I said, yeah, you can, but it comes with me. And I finally got the job.
Considering her early fascination with the night sky and with rockets and with science generally, you might be surprised that Acevedo didn't stay at JPL, NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, or return there after she got her graduate degree. I asked her why not.
The thing was, when you're working with NASA, and especially when you're working with missions that are going to different planets, payday or Christmas is when that actual spacecraft is passing that planet. And I was able to work right when Voyager 2 was doing its flyby of Jupiter and its moons, Io and Europa. And I got to do a lot of data analysis and actually create algorithms around that of all the data that was coming back from the telemetry devices. Then the other project was Solar Polar Solar Probe, where we were planning to send a spacecraft to the sun.
The Solar Polar Project had been conceived in the late 1950s. Acevedo worked at JPL in 1979, but the mission still had a long way to go. The science itself fascinated her.
You had to think about all these different things that were going to happen. And, you know, even some of the material to handle the radiation, obviously the heat, the temperature fluctuations, you know, asteroids hitting it. Some of the material of the ceramics hadn't even been created yet.
But the timetable of the project was a problem.
And I realized it was going to be not just months, not just years, it could be decades before the next great event happened.
Indeed, Solar Polar, later renamed the Parker Solar Probe, was finally launched last year in 2018. Acevedo had not been interested in waiting it out, so she got that graduate degree in engineering from Stanford.
And then I saw everything happening around Silicon Valley, and I really liked the pace. I was fortunate to graduate from Stanford right at sort of ground zero of the internet explosion.
Over the next few decades, Acevedo worked for Apple, Dell, Autodesk, and in her first job, IBM.
You know, when I worked at IBM, we were creating the state-of-the-art storage devices. And I brought an innovation lens to it. Instead of just doing it the way everybody did it, I kind of took a step back and I thought, what could we do to make this an improved experience for the workers as well as improve our manufacturing output? Well, I did that with a few projects and manufacturing outcomes went out. So the results were so good that I was given this amazing plum assignment to help design their brand new state-of-the-art manufacturing facility. But, you know, working at IBM, I noticed that men would have this way of coaching each other and networking with each other. And I saw that the few women that were there, we weren't doing that, and no one was doing that for us. So I went to my boss and I said, what will it take to get promoted, to get to these other levels? And he said, you'd have to have sales experience, product, all this experience. And that was kind of the ticket. And I thought, okay, I want to do that. And so at that point, I applied and got accepted into the IBM sales program. And then I just went checking the box and kept working on getting myself into these other types of jobs, product marketing, into having profit and loss responsibility as an executive.
Next week on Freakonomics Radio, we'll hear the rest of Silvia Acevedo's story. In the meantime, you can download our podcast on any podcast app. The entire archive, use the free Stitcher app or go to freakonomics.com. I'm Stephen Dubner, and I thank you for listening.